This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have Stephanie Pintoff. She has written a new book called City on Edge, a really orange and yellowish cover. I love this cover. Hello.
Oh, hi, David. Thanks for inviting me on today.
What's the orange and the yellow? It's really a bright cover. I mean, it's going to stand out in all the bookstores, that's for sure.
Yeah, hopefully so, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's Thanksgiving colors. Goes right with the theme of the book, right?
Right. Thanksgiving. Did you do a lot of research about the Thanksgiving parade?
I did and I didn't. You know, it's one of those things where, as a New York writer, you know, yes, you do the research, but you also live the research. So the book takes place in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And it starts when the balloons are inflated the afternoon before the parade. And this is something that for years has happened right in my back door, in my neighborhood. So, you know, for many, many years, those of us who were kind of in the know, we knew that we could walk up to the American Museum of Natural History on the Upper West Side, starting around noon, day before the parade, and to stroll around and watch all of the giant character balloons come to life.
But you mentioned a lot of little details about the balloons and stuff, so you must have done some kind of research on it.
Oh, yeah,
okay,
definitely.
Yeah. That's what I was kind of getting at.
When you're walking around, at least before it was quite the tourist attraction it is now, you can just talk to the people who are working there. They're so happy. It's a festive environment. They're happy to answer your questions and talk to you. So, you know, I probably had a number of those conversations years ago that I never quite knew I was going to use in the book.
Well, this book is very, very good. I mean,
thank you.
I read it a lot of it last night as I was drifting off to sleep, and then I would wake up and pull it out again. I had to get back to it. That's the kind of book it is. You're just like, oh, I can't wait to see what's going to happen next. And you really feel that sense of urgency as the book goes on.
And great.
That's what I really like about the book, that heightened suspense that, you know, what the hell is going on? And who is this person, you know?
Yeah.
It feels good. And that's what it should feel like when you read a book. You can't wait to get back to it.
Especially a thriller.
Right, exactly. And I love the fact that the chapters are short. So if you're falling asleep at night because you're tired, not tired of reading the book, just tired in general, you know, you can pick it up. You know, you can get to the end of the chapter real quick. That's cool.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can think of, there are other authors who write short chapters. I don't think it's as effective. But for some reason, yours, it's very effective.
Oh, thank you.
And I think, but you have all these characters, these crazy characters in your book, and they're all pretty smart people. So is that a little difficult for you to write about characters that are really, I mean, they're really that intelligent?
They are, but in really different ways with very different skill sets.
I mean, do you know people like this?
I know a few of them, yeah.
Oh, you do?
Quite a few, yeah.
I mean, are they modeled after these characters? These people you know?
Only certain elements of them, you know, barring certain traits of personality.
I don't know. I can't imagine how it would feel to be in somebody's book.
Yeah, well.
That would be weird, I think. But maybe I could get used to it.
Yeah.
Especially if the royalties kept rolling in. Yeah, maybe I could get used to it, you know. But to be that all your little foibles would be put in a book would be a little weird.
Yeah, but I've never taken all the foibles from one person. You know,
it's a combination.
Exactly.
So nobody recognizes. Like
one would possibly recognize it.
When you were writing books about historical New York, now you've turned to this VDOC thing.
Yes.
Very effective. And a lot of times authors do that, and I don't always like what the direction they go in. But this is good. This is really good stuff.
Oh, thank you. And of course, Vidocq's based on what I thought was a really cool historical legend too. And that's the premise for my guys, who are working in this secret FBI unit. You know, Vidocq was France's most notorious criminal. And he eventually got old, it happens to all of us, and decided that what he wanted to do was get a clean slate. So he offered his services to the French police and ended up becoming head of the French police himself.
How long did he work for the French police? I mean, how many, a long period of time?
Yeah, it was over a decade, you know. But essentially, when he first got going with them, you know, he made the same deal that he offered later to other criminals and that I've used for my guys. You know, either continue to do your hard time in jail or put your skills to work for the government and do some good. Because he felt back in 18th, 19th century, the same thing that I've made use of today, that sometimes the people who have the best knowledge about something aren't exactly on the proper side of the law. And I think that's especially true with my computer hacker. You know, a lot of the very cutting edge work that's being done in technology, people who have the know-how to hack into anything, you know, it's not exactly the people who are always on the kosher side.
Exactly. And it's kind of scary when you think about it, that there are people out there who can do all of this, get into your, and learn your innermost secrets. I mean, nobody wants that to happen, I wouldn't think, you know. It's because there's always something they can find, even if it's just a little embarrassing.
Exactly.
I guess. But these characters of yours, they're not exactly the most likable guys.
No.
Did you do that intentionally? Make them unlikable?
I do think that's something that helps make any character more well-rounded and realistic, because no one is all good qualities. You know, everyone has flaws. My guys have some pretty major flaws, but they also have some pretty major talents and some good points. And I think it's when you're creating characters who have that balance that you go the furthest toward creating the characters who feel real to readers.
Right, but they have to. There has to be something redeeming about them. If they're totally unlikable, then I wouldn't think people would want to read the books. But these are just intriguing enough to want to read more about them. It's like you want to know more about these guys and what makes them tick, why they're socially inept in a lot of ways.
Right.
Why the crowds don't? I mean, why the crowd? They wouldn't want to be in a crowd. You know, it's weird to think that these people are they could be holed up in a house for the rest of their lives and they wouldn't even care. You know, they really, that's the sense I get about these guys.
Yeah, especially Eli.
Except maybe Garcia. I think Garcia is a little different, but you know,
he's
a little more open to, and I just love the way these characters are. I mean, and you, Eli is, they're all have their different things, and they all don't necessarily get along either.
Right, exactly. their egos are too big.
But Eve,
now you're going to have a clash.
Now, Eve Rossi, now, are you something like Eve Rossi in some ways?
I don't think so.
Not at all?
I get asked that a lot, but I really don't think so. She is a lot stronger than I am.
Stronger in what ways?
Braver. She has more talent. She does more things. You know, I went to a kind of watered-down civilian academy that the FBI runs for people who are civilians who want to know more about what the FBI does, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of describe it as like a watered-down version, very watered-down of what real agents learn at the FBI academy. So, you know, among other things, I got to go to the shooting range and try to shoot the kind of weapons that Eve shoots. And I'm sure she gets an almost perfect score when she's up for training every year. You know, I could barely fire the thing. And, you know, you learn about the different technology and just the kind of amazing skill set that agents need to have to work in different divisions of law enforcement and And
well, you've taken on, I mean, this is quite a series you've taken on. There's a lot of little details you have to get right. So in some ways, that's very brave, you know, to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, because once you start on a path like this, I mean, you can't let up. Every book's got to be detailed and correct, and you got to do with different things. I assume this is going to be a series.
Hopefully so.
We've already got two.
I have two.
This Hostage Taker is the next one I'm going to read. I can't wait to read it. The characters are just so interesting. It's like you want to know more about them. Like I said, I want to know what these people are like. And I assume that's what you're planning on future books.
Yeah. I mean, my own favorite series writers do that, so that's a bit of my blueprint model that, you know, with every book, you should learn just a little more about each one, and particularly Eve and her background. You get a little more in this book than you got in Hostage Taker, but that's a story that I would expect to tease out in future installments. So.
It's interesting because it seems like in recent books there's been a lot of shocks, like on the last page. I know on the recent Louise Penny book, there was a real big shock on the last page of the book, and Harlan Coben did the same thing. They like to leave you hanging for the next book, which I think is interesting. I really enjoy them doing that.
Yeah.
Because you want to, there's something they drop about the character that you didn't know before, and then, wow, it's like, well, now you got to let me read the next book.
Right, exactly.
It's like when you watch a TV show, you have to wait another week to watch the next episode. It's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, you have the cliffhangers.
Yeah.
Of course, everyone does that because they want to bring the audience back.
Right, the ultimate cliffhanger being that Walking Dead one they did over the summer, which was nearly driving me insane.
Oh, that's on my list. I haven't seen that yet, so don't tell me.
Yeah. But I mean, they just held you in. It was worse than the Who Shot JR episode. But you're too young to remember that, though.
No, unfortunately, I'm not. I do remember Who Shot JR.
Oh, you do, really?
Yeah.
I mean, that was the ultimate one. I mean, that's the one
everybody. Exactly.
But did you, when you started the series, did you plan it on being a certain number of books, or is it just go as you can? Or
it's really go as I can. What I did do in planning it was, you know, with my first historical series, I had one first person detective narrator, and as I was hitting the third book in that series, I was feeling a little limited, so. In planning this next series, one of the things I purposely wanted was having Eve and a whole team of interesting guys, anyone who could stand alone, you know, is the idea that as things go along, you know, a couple different things can happen. For one, right now there's five of them, but that doesn't mean that going forward there couldn't be six or seven. I see the team being open.
I don't know if you've, the team kind of reminds me of the ones from P.J. Tracy's books, The Monkey Man.
Okay.
I kind of get that. It kind of, it's the same kind of vibe, that weird, but I like these characters kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Sort of, and I'm sure there's plenty of examples in movies and TV. I can't think of one offhand, but yeah, that's it. And Eve herself, Eve is kind of holding the group together. She's the one that kind of, she's like the referee, almost.
Right. At the moment, she's the glue that makes them all stick.
So what is it about Eve? I mean, Eve is such an interesting character. We don't know much about her personal life, at least in this book. I don't know if there's more revealed in the first book or not.
There's a little, but, you know, again, it's two things. One, it's the specific plan that should get teased out over a number of books. I don't want to give away too much too fast. And part of it is that it's a thriller.
And Eve doesn't have much time for a personal life.
She doesn't have much time for a personal life. And, you know, as you're racing along with the plot, you know, you should get a good bit about Eve, but, you know, it's always secondary to what's happening with the action.
There's questions I want to ask, but I'm afraid I'm going to give away part of the book if I ask them. So there's one thing you did in this book that I didn't like, and I think you know what it is, but we can't bring it up because it'll spoil.
It might be a spoiler. Okay.
I think you could probably figure it out. But
if it has to do with the future of the team, yes, I can figure that one out.
But it's like, when you, you know, and I, but I like the fact that I'm going to see more of these characters and see, you know, and discover more things about them. And even Eve, you know, what's up with Eve, and is she ever going to have a normal life? It doesn't right. look that way, right?
Right, right. Well, she doesn't have a normal job, so odds are not in her favor.
What's a normal life anyway? Do you have a normal life?
I don't think anybody has a normal life, no.
I mean, how many hours a week do you spend writing?
It really varies by where I am in the process, but if it's in the sort of creative time where I'm actively writing a new manuscript, I'll generally start and spend about the first hour of the morning going back on what I've done so far, doing some light editing of what I've written the day before.
There's a lot of repetitive things going over and over to make sure everything's
right. Yeah. But then I'll pick up and I try to move forward, I think, less in terms of hours than in terms of word count. I try to aim for about 1,500 words a day. And if that takes me 6 hours, it takes me 6 hours. If it flows well and I'm done in 3 to 4, even better.
So at this point, is there going to be a book 3 and a book 4?
I hope so.
Okay. That's not a definite, though.
No, it's not a definite.
So. Oh, God, that's terrible. I want more of these books. Maybe you could just write them for me.
Hopefully people support them and there'll be more books. I definitely hope
so. Well, I can't imagine. They want this so good. I mean, I can't imagine that people who read it aren't going to enjoy it and want more. You know,
Thank you. And
I really mean that. I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing you. I really did enjoy the book an awful lot. And the more I got into it, the more I did enjoy it.
Great.
Well, why don't you explain the plot to people who are sitting at home thinking, what the hell is this book about? Tell me.
Sure. So essentially, it opens that Wednesday afternoon before the Thanksgiving Day parade. And everyone is gathered by the Natural History Museum. They are watching the balloons inflate. And it's through the eyes of a 13-year-old girl named Allie Donovan. And she's a little bit special because she's the police commissioner's daughter. And as part of a public relations move, the police commissioner is on hand to dedicate a brand new character balloon. Because that is one of the things that Macy's typically does every year. We get new balloons almost every year, right?
Depending on what's popular, I would guess.
Exactly. I mean,
there's probably like a wimpy kid balloon.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there definitely is.
Maybe like a SpongeBob SquarePants one or something?
Yes, all of those. So, and they cycle in and out. It changes a little bit every year. But as she's wandering around and watching the inflation, a couple things happen. First of all, this is a public relations move for her father because there have been a number of incidents lately between police and community, and the police are not very popular. He knows he's a man with a target on his back, and that comes about when, during the inflation, he's shot at. There's a riot that ensues, and during all this chaos and confusion, Allie is kidnapped. And you're not quite sure why, but Donovan knows he has, you know, an infinite array of enemies, so he's not quite sure who he can trust either. But he remembers Eve Rossi from the case that was the subject of the first book in the series, Hostage Taker.
Mm-hmm.
So he turns to her and her team because he knows they do a few things very well. They're fast. They cut through the bureaucracy. They don't, they're not hung up. They're a secret unit with ultimate plausible deniability. So they're able to do things and not worry about the political niceties. They get the job done especially well. So from there, it takes off into this cat and mouse game where, essentially they're trying to find the kidnapper. Vidoc is trying to help them. Eve is trying to help the commissioner. But they run into a couple of problems because they figure out that this commissioner has a number of secrets that he'd rather nobody know about, especially even the team.
And talk about a complex,
might help him.
Right. Talk about a complex guy.
Yeah. So even if it would help him find his daughter, they'd rather, you know, he doesn't want to lay open his soul. And you're never quite sure until you reach near the end of the book what the end game is of the kidnapper. You know, why exactly has he kidnapped Allie? And is this a personal vendetta, or is it a larger threat to all of the parade and all of New York? So, you know, in that sense, Eve is balancing threats that are both personal and global. And I think that's very much something that, you know, real life law enforcement, not just my fictional counterpart, is always dealing with when you have these large events like the parade.
So. You like to put maps in your books. Interesting.
Yeah, I do. you know, other authors that I read have done that, and I just love it because I guess I'm a very visual person, so I like being able to see what the author's talking about. You know, especially if you've never been here and you've never actually seen the layout and the way the parade moves, I think it's a help.
Yeah, I can't imagine the sheer number of people that go down that are watching this parade. It's just got to be amazing to watch.
Yeah, I'm not remembering that. I feel like the number might have been 3 million.
That's a lot of people.
Might have been. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, are there usually injuries, or has there ever been threats during the parades that you know of?
I get the feeling that it's one of those things where no one will admit to the specific threat, but I'm sure there are
constant threats. They hide it.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to, it's a publicity thing, I guess. They just want the city to look good. And that's understandable, you know. Why wouldn't you want your city to look good? Everybody loves New York. But everybody knows at the same time there's tons of people walking around. I remember the first time I was there, I was just overwhelmed by the number of people that were around me.
Yes.
And you really have to keep your wits about you if you're walking through the city.
Right.
Now, I assume you've lived in New York City for a while?
It's been a while, yeah. Certainly my entire adult life. So.
What do you like about writing? I mean, you're really good at it. I mean, you really are terrific at writing. I mean, well, what do you like about it the most? And are there ever days that you just want to throw up your hands and give up?
Yeah, there are. I think there are for most writers. But, you know, it's one of those things, I suppose, for me is almost a compulsion. I started off as a reader, and I can't imagine not reading, and reading broadly and widely and incessantly.
Well, how do you keep it separate, though? The reading and not making it bleed into your writing a little better. Is that difficult?
I don't think so, and I also think that to a certain extent, I think all of us, we become better as a writer the more we read. Like, it all sort of, you know, it's like the stew that you're cooking on the stove. Everything that goes into the pot does something to enrich your ideas.
Do you ever get an idea while you're reading other books?
I mean, don't think I have, actually. Because when I'm reading somebody else's other book, I'm so immersed in that world.
Yeah.
And I don't want to leave it. And I don't even mentally leave it in terms of my own.
That's one of the worst feelings about reading is when you don't want a book to end and you know it's going to and you can't stop it from ending. And it's almost like, I don't know how to even describe it, but because I've experienced it more than a couple times lately. And there's a book called, What She Knew that just came out by Jillian McMillan. Oh my God. I did not want that book to end. I still don't want it to end.
Look at that.
And, you know, there's something about a book that really gets to you. That book really got to me. I mean,
yeah.
The way it's written, and to think it's our first novel is just amazing. But I bring that one up because that's the one I remember recently. But it's just so incredible. You're right in the middle of the book, and you're thinking, I really don't want this to end. I don't want to race through this book and not have another book to read.
Right.
And that feeling is just awful.
It is. There are actually some authors who I won't read a certain book because then that means I will have finished their series and I don't want to be done.
Right.
P.D. James is one of them.
Oh, yeah.
I miss her. I miss her terribly. And
well, the good news is there's some short stories of hers that it just came out. A book
yeah.
of her short stories. I haven't read them. I don't know what they're like, but I don't think I ever read a short story by her, so it'll be interesting to see how she handles it.
Yeah, I've never read one either.
So. The short stories to me are either really good or really bad.
Yeah.
But the last book that Stephen King wrote, The Bizarre Bad Dreams, that book is incredible.
Yes, I love that book.
Oh my God. I was like, wow, this is how you should write short stories, you know?
Yeah. And what was so spectacular about that too is he finished each one by posting that little vignette that described exactly, you know, something about the inspiration for
right.
the story.
Oh, yeah.
That was the best window into it.
Sometimes I think Stephen King is too brilliant for the rest of us.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when they hand out brilliance, they gave him more than his share.
Yeah.
There's something. But was this book tougher to write than the first book?
They're all tough to write in a different way.
I mean, this book is shorter than the first book, but I'm just wondering in terms of how difficult it was. I mean, yeah, I would guess the ideas are easy to come up with. It's the execution of the idea that's the difficult part, I would think.
Exactly. And it's also making sure that all the ideas that you have for the book actually fit tightly with the book and don't disrupt the pacing. You know, keeping sort of to what's primary and using what fits it and being brave enough to cut what doesn't.
Well, you're published now by a major author, a major publishing house. Random House is a major publishing house, so that's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you.
I think you were with St. Martin's when you did the first series, was it?
I was.
Yeah.
They were fantastic as well.
Yeah. I mean,
absolutely fantastic.
So you're being published, you must have some talent. I can tell you, I've read, now having read about four or five of your books, you are talented. And I really mean that. And, you know, I can tell you, I pick up books and read them, and sometimes I don't know what it is. I just can't get into a book. And then other people will say how great it is, and I'll think, well, what's the matter with me? Why can't I read this book? And you think it's you, but, I mean, everything's unique. You know, you could have 5 million people love a book, and one person will always hate it.
Right.
or find some kind of flaw with it.
Yeah, I think it's just it's diversity of readership. Something debated sometimes with a friend is sometimes there's a difference, I think, between movies and books. Sometimes there's more universal agreement about what makes a good movie. Whereas with what's a good book, it feels like that's more highly personal. It really goes to personal taste, what someone responds to and is looking for.
Right. It's interesting you say that. I have a friend who I recommend books to all the time, and she tells me, you've never recommended a bad book to me. So I feel like I have a pulse on certain people.
Yeah.
I certainly know that a book, when I read a book and I know whether she's going to like it or not, I can tell her right away whether she's going to like it, because I just know by the way it reads whether she's going to get into it as much as I. I'm talking, for instance, the new Tana French book, The Trespasser, which I thought was phenomenal. She thought was a little slow at times. I didn't see that at all. And, you know, and it's interesting. That's what makes book group so interesting, because you get so many different opinions.
Right.
One person will say, well, I thought it was a little slow then, or somebody will pick apart a certain item that was wrong in it. I don't always, when a writer writes good, I don't notice the mistakes a lot of times.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like to go for the ride and just enjoy it.
I'm not going to be this person that says, well, you got that wrong and you messed that up. That's not who I am, and that's not what I want. I want to enjoy the book, like you say, just enjoy it.
Right, and I think the most important thing is the spirit that the book is trying to invoke.
Do you? Right.
And if it's doing that, it's doing its job.
And I think with what she knew, it was more about the characters. The characters just come to life, completely come to life. And that's, you know, it's like watching a puppet show. These, you know, the puppets just come to life. You know, in your mind, you just, you know these characters, you feel for these characters, and you're along for the ride. And you miss them when they're not there anymore.
Right.
I remember Lisa Scottolini had a gay character in her first book. She had a really, really funny gay character. But the gay character doesn't last the whole book. And I every time I see her, I remind her of that. I said, you've got to bring him back somehow. Because there's a certain magic to certain characters.
Yeah.
I know Ann Perry's got an aunt in one of her books that's just the most fantastic aunt you'd ever want to meet. And I keep, every time she comes into the story, I get excited because I'm like, I love this character.
Right.
And the same with Nana Mama in James Patterson's series. You know, there's all these different ones. But I think your characters are going to be like that. I think Eve's going to be like that. And these guys certainly are, they make me laugh.
Oh, good.
Because they're quirky. They're unusual. They're not the type that or you're not going to see them on TV with their own talk shows, you know.
Right.
They don't like the limelight. Are you like that? Are you shy?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of writers are, right?
If you were put on a talk show to talk about your book today, would it scare you to death?
Only because I feel I know my book fairly well, so I could handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd much rather be writing. You know,
what is it?
Like a lot of writers,
I
like being behind the pen and behind the computer, not so much in front of the camera.
With your first book, what was it like to actually read it out loud to people? Did it feel weird to you, or did it feel natural?
It feels natural, but what's really weird and eye-opening is having the book read to you. All my books have gone to audio tape, and I love the narrator who is narrating both Hostage Taker and City on Edge, Tanya Eby. And she does such a fabulous job capturing all of the voices, but especially Haddock's and his Irish brogue. And when she reads the book out loud, I'm mesmerized even though I wrote those words.
That's it. That's fascinating.
It's the best feeling.
It must be. Did you have a say in who was going to read the books?
No, that just got very lucky because she's fabulous.
They just said to you, this is who we're hiring and you have no say in them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure somebody has some say and, you know, they chose incredibly well.
Exactly. I mean, and I don't know who chooses those people, but they seem to always know what they're doing. I mean, it's like you have to give them a certain credit for being able to do that. I'm sure there's ones that didn't sound all that great, but they really seem to do a good job. Do you listen to audiobooks on tape?
I don't listen to a lot because, you know, New York City girl, I tend to be on the subway more than I'm in the car. And it tends to be when I'm on a road trip somewhere that I want to put the book on tape in and listen to it. But it's definitely, it's a different level of appreciation because, it ends up being more dramatic than I can ever do it in my own head. And I invariably find something about characters which, you know, especially in a series where you have the recurring characters that, you know, I might already think I know and love, a good narrator will put a brand new spin on that.
Exactly.
Cool.
Do you now have an idea for the third book?
I do. I've been working on it.
I'm excited now.
Yeah. So the main premise is taking Eve back into her past, revealing something about her stepfather and how choices he made many years ago have impacted the path she's taking now.
This one will definitely be published?
No. So if readers want to know that one, they really need to support City on Edge.
Oh,
nothing
really?
Nothing in this business.
Oh, God, I would be devastated if there wasn't another book. I really mean that. I mean,
Thank you.
I interview authors a lot, and people at home probably think, oh, he's just saying that because he's interviewing the author. No, I really, we wouldn't be talking now if I didn't like your book. I mean, what would be the point of talking to an author if you didn't like the book?
Right.
It would be, unless you wanted to find out something about the author, but that would be very self-serving. I wouldn't even. But what do you normally read, mysteries and thrillers?
I do. I try to branch out now and then with something else, but that's my study diet.
It's what you like.
It's what I like. It's what I've always liked. I mean, probably from the time I was, 10 years old, picked up my first Agatha Christie or Sherlock Holmes. It's what I like to read. And, you always hear that advice saying write what you know, but I think it's actually more important to write what you love.
What do you do when you get to an author who you really love and you start reading one of the books and you don't like the book? Do you put it down or do you go through to the end?
I'm trying to think. I don't think that's happened to me yet.
I can think of some authors where some of their books were just not as good as others. And
I guess that there are some where, especially if it's a very long-running series, maybe there's something about the plot in that particular book that isn't, it might not appeal as much as I can think back, 5 years ago, now that was a plot I really liked, but, that when that's happened to me, it's always been the case with a long-running series, and there's usually been something about going on with the characters themselves, which I'm so connected to by this point that, I'll forgive a lot with the plot if it doesn't call to me as much. And, I think in the end, the plot isn't what we remember as much. We walk away from a book we really loved, and it's the characters that we remember. Mm-hmm. It's Hannibal Lecter, or it's Jack Reacher, or it's Harry Bosch. We remember them. We don't remember the details of the cases that introduced us to them.
I do remember The Poet, though, by Michael Connelly. What a great book that was.
Yeah,
I remember when I first.
One of my all-time favorites, for sure.
I that's one of those books I looked at. I said, I'm not going to read a book called The Poet. What kind of a book is that? The Poet? Why would he call it The Poet? And I guess that made me want to read the book, because I'm like, I have to know why he's called The Poet. So the title hooked me for some reason, and I had no idea what I was in for, how wonderful it was really going to be. And, there's a skilled writer for you, somebody who really knows what they're doing.
Definitely.
But we live in a society now where it seems like, we have a proliferation of books right now, which is nice. But sometimes I feel like, writers are writing 2 or 3 books a year, and maybe they suffer a little bit because of that. I mean, could you ever write 3 books a year?
Perhaps after my daughter graduates high school.
Well, that would be...
not right now, though. Not with a current
life. That would be very hard, though.
I think it would be very hard.
I don't know how you would do it. I mean, literally, you'd be writing all the time.
Yeah.
You'd have no social life. You wouldn't be able to go out and walk down the street. You can't very well write while you're walking down the street. I don't think it really works that way,
Writers I respect a great deal and I think are producing amazing work. I've sometimes managed 2 a year. The most I've can think of anyone doing and doing well.
But it's like we have Sue Grafton who takes 2 or 3 years, but what a weight it is. It's so cool when she finally produces a book and you get excited. You think, I can't wait to see what it's like.
Yeah.
And it's such a thrill. I mean, that thrill, you can't ever replace that thrill. I mean, it's just so wonderful. I mean, you've got people, Lee Child, Booklist, loved your book, Library Journal, Jeffrey Deaver, Michael Cordia. I guess that's how you say his name. I haven't interviewed him in years. But you got all these people who read and really loved your book. Do you get nervous giving people your books to read? That they're not
always. Always. Every single book.
You think,
I never know.
But do they really tell, do you have people who really tell you if they don't like something about the book?
Certainly with the first group of people, I guess starting with my editor, I think almost you have to be very lucky with your editor as sort of that first line of defense. Because exactly what you were describing before with your friend, where you say, well, I know her taste. I can tell from the way something's written if she'll like it.
Right.
I'm lucky to have a brilliant editor who I do think has her pulse somehow on what people like to read. So I usually kind of study myself that, you know, if the editor likes it and thinks it's good and that people will like it, well, then they probably will, at least the majority. But you never know.
And you know what? I mean, I can tell you there's only one thing I didn't like about your book, and I can't discuss what that is. And off,
yes,
off the air, I can discuss.
Spoiler, yes.
Just for one thing. That was the only problem I had with the whole book. And I think you know what it is already anyway. But people out there are thinking, what the? Well, you're going to have to read the book to find out, because I'm not telling you right now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's so much that goes with a book. I mean, you think you don't want to have a title that sounds too trite. You want to have a title that hooks the reader. You want to have a story that hooks the reader. You want to have characters that people can enjoy and relate to. And maybe have a villain that they can hate.
Right. Exactly.
A Negan. You know who Negan is?
I don't, actually. I haven't heard that term.
He's the new villain on The Walking Dead.
Oh, okay.
When you meet him, you're never going to
forget. I'm so behind with that series.
Well, trust me, when you meet Negan, you're never going to forget him.
Okay. Right.
You'll know what I mean. I feel like I'm hooked on this silly show, but it isn't really silly. I really enjoy it, but I sometimes think, why do I like watching violence on TV? What is it about me that I can enjoy violence on TV? And I don't know. Do we love violence? Are we a society of violence lovers?
Well, I do think it's probably related in some ways to that adrenaline rush you get, right?
Thriller. Your book is not what I would call violent. It's just a kind of psychological violence.
Right, and it's that adrenaline roller coaster ride where you're up, you're down. Hopefully, there's a few times the rug is pulled out from under you as a reader.
And what I ended up thinking when I'm reading the book is, what would it feel like to have your daughter missing and not know where she is in the city of New York, where there's millions of people, and that you may never see them again? What would that feel like?
Yeah. I have a friend who is afraid to take her kids to the Thanksgiving Day parade for that reason. It's just that crowded.
Well, don't let her read your book. She'll never take them again.
I know.
To be like, you know, and it's a valid fear. I mean, but can you live your life in fear? That's the thing, you know, and I don't know.
Right.
Everybody has to do what they feel is right. And, you know, and being protective of your kids is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
That's how I look at it. Now, you have one child?
Just one.
And she's about ready to graduate, you said?
No, still at early stages, high school.
Now, does she read your books?
So far, not yet.
None? She's never read one of your books?
Not yet.
Wouldn't you like her to?
At some point, when she wants to, when she's ready.
Do you, if you had your way right now, would this book be would you go on just writing books in this series?
This series is tremendous fun to write. And I will keep writing it as long as somebody wants me to. That would be fabulous.
When you started writing, you didn't have any plan as far as how many books it was going to be. I mean, your first series was...
Other than wanting it to be open-ended, you know, with possibilities that, you know, if the characters take off, I could certainly see, you know, Mace having his own book, which everyone else is a supporting character, or Haddix could get his own book. You know, they're the kind of characters who could stand by themselves. The series is established and people wanted, you know, more of each individual story.
I wonder how...
Focus more on them.
And it makes me think, how would Mace be on his own? That's what I'm wondering. How would the other characters be on their own? How would Eli do on his own? And I'm thinking,
yeah,
I don't know. That would be interesting to.
They're always going to need the support of the rest of the team. Yeah, they might not like each other on the team, but they need each other on the team.
I'm thinking of the bandana.
You
know, that's the thing with your book. There's so many visual images that I come away with, things that happen in the book that I can't get out of my head now because they're imprinted in my brain. I mean, eventually I'll forget them, but, you know, for now, I run through some of the scenes in my head and I can see them in my mind.
That's actually how I write them. I'm very visual, and those are the things that anchor me when
I'm trying
to.
Yeah, are there some writers who aren't visual, do you think, or do you think all writers are visual?
I think some are more so than others. Maybe thriller writers more so than others, because thrillers do tend to be more action-packed.
Well, we both know that, you know,
into the setting.
Right. With thriller writers, you know, you either get a sense of the characters or you don't. What they look like, what they're like, or you don't get that sense. And I think that, you know, and that's one of the dangers of writing books over and over and over again. Maybe you lose that ability to do that, to really picture the characters, or maybe a writer will write the same kind of character each time. A woman in trouble, or a man in trouble, or children in trouble, whatever it might be, you know?
Right, right.
So you don't have a sense of that person because of the fact that every book has that same kind of thing to it. And when I read an author's books, I want the characters to stand out in my mind. I want to feel like I know these characters. That's important.
Right. But to your point earlier, I do think, you know, maybe more within literary books, but I do think there are writers who can create the characters that stand out, that it's less visual. It's more taking you into that interior life of the mind of the character. And it's just a different style of book.
That's what made Girl on the Train so good. I mean, we could feel we were inside this woman's head, and we were being voyeuristic like she was. We were seeing these things that she was seeing. And it's kind of a weird feeling. And I kind of like, you kind of think to yourself, well, I'm glad I'm not the only person who likes to look at other people, you know? It's like, yeah.
I know. And I know reading that book, you know, of course, like everybody, I'm reminded of Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly and Rear Window.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, interesting that was kind of the visual, you know, the Hitchcock version of that same impulse.
And don't forget Thelma Ritter, how wonderful she was in that movie.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain characters that just they're without them. You can't imagine the movie without them.
Exactly.
And the same thing with books. I mean, I can't imagine your books without these weirdo characters. I'm not the first person that's called them weird, because they are weird.
Yeah, they're quirky and they march to the beat of their own drum. All of those quirky.
Do you have any quirky friends like that?
Yeah, most people do here in New York. I mean, even just for one example, you know, my character Eli, he lives in his grandma's rent control department down in the Lower East Side, and he's never going to move because the rent for this huge, you know, 7-room spread is probably something like $200 a month. And in New York City with rent control, that will never go up. And I know a number of people that have these kind of apartments.
Really?
And yeah, you know, they can inherit them just like you would property. And, you know, typically the landlord would prefer them to move out so that, you know, market rent can be charged, or, you know, even rent stabilization, which is different because then you can at least increase a certain percentage every month. Rent control is fixed, and people who have those apartments, they don't leave. They'll renovate themselves. They'll do whatever they have to do. But
it's to survive.
That,
you know,
New York story, yeah. But I think, you know, in that kind of circumstance, in that kind of place, and in this kind of city, you know, it leads to a certain mentality, a certain very inward-looking kind of life where, you know, you don't maybe look quite so much outside your neighborhood stoop or your street or your local environs. Maybe you get a little scared too.
Yeah, I want to know more about Celine.
Oh yeah.
I mean, in your mind, do you have more of a picture of her than we do right now? Of what she's like and what she's, I mean, what kind of personality she has? Is she full of herself? She's obviously beautiful.
Yes. No, this is Mace's new girlfriend. You at least meet the idea of her. Because in this book anyway, that's how she's important.
But
she's important to Mace because it represents this turn in his personal life.
But let's assume there's going to be three or four more books, will we get to know that much more about her?
Absolutely. I see her as being permanent in Mace's life, which is new for Mace. He doesn't do permanent well. But
if I asked you to draw her, would you be able to draw what she looked like?
For me, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Now, I have a very fixed idea of what each character should look like, whether they're major or minor. But I do usually sidestep that question that, you know, sometimes you get asked, like, oh, if it went to the Hollywood screen, who would you want to play? Because I do want readers to come up with their own ideas, and I don't want to interfere with that.
You do have an Asian character here, and I noticed he was kind of on the hefty side. I'm like, I'm trying to think, when have I ever seen an Asian that was really heavy?
Like all people. All people come in all shapes.
As I recall, the commissioner's kind of a big guy too, isn't he?
He was. And then, you know, recent events, he lost his wife. When Eve first sees him, one of the first things she notices is how much weight he's lost. So we see him and
that's what grief will do to you, I guess.
Size, yeah.
I'm trying to find the page where he's on. It tells his weight. I thought it said two something, but I.
Well, he's a big, tall guy, but he's.
And I wonder where that's going, but I can't say anything more than that.
Yeah, that would be another thread that would pick up in the future.
And I'm looking forward to. There's so much I'm looking forward to with these characters. I can't wait for book three.
Oh, thank you.
I really mean that. It's been a pleasure to talk to you again.
Oh, you too. Thank you so much for having me back. It's been a while since the first book, and
it has, and I'm
much fun today.
And hopefully, we'll see a book next year, the year after. Let's hope.
Let's hope.
Yes.
Definitely.
The new book's called City on Edge. It's out from Bantam Books. Stephanie Pintoff is the author. She's been here the whole hour. It's been a pleasure. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.